is Radio 314 on the Red Ice Radio Network.
Welcome, everyone. This is Lana. I have an unexpected show for you today, one that some might not want or care to hear, but I ask that you stick with the entire interview. Gay, trans, and bi is a more frequent reality in the West, and it's not simply because of cultural Marxism, although some fall into that category because it's cooler to be gay these days. However, it's far more complicated than a simple choice, cultural programming, or sexual abuse from childhood. Claire Randall is back, but this time we'll discuss the biology and neurology of homosexuality and gender dysphoria, among other related topics. The biological aspect of what makes one attracted to the same sex, or what causes one to feel they were born the wrong sex, is never discussed in gender studies. Why? Because that's where the answers lie. Instead, we're told that sexual attraction is merely a social construct, a choice that has no biological connection whatsoever. This is false. Just like the biology of race, we used to have an understanding of the biology of sexuality. Biology is now swept under the rug because sexuality and race has been weaponized, used for political purposes. How can we disarm it? We can keep reminding others of biology. It's based on physical, testable evidence, not made-up abstract ideas. Gender dysphoria used to be treated as a medical condition because we knew the biological and neurological aspects to it, although the best procedures weren't always taken. And research has been halted in the area of what biologically creates gender dysphoria to discover ways to get positive, healthy results to reverse the confusion. I'm not talking about thumping a Bible over one's head. None of this has anything to do with religion and whether you think gay or trans is right or wrong. I'm talking about the biological aspects and the root causes. Because as we know, with gender confusion and homosexuality, there's no offspring. That gene would die out if we didn't have surrogacy. Today, talking about the biological aspects of what creates LGBT is not allowed because it would hurt people's feelings, because liberalism has made people so weak. So facing science is even considered hate. Fast forward to today, years of unexplored research later, and we haphazardly cut dicks and boobs off and administer opposite sex hormones without even considering other possible solutions first, without even knowing the cause in the first place. I think those in question would gladly try a healthy, positive solution to avoid the hell they feel from being born the wrong sex. But these days, the left dismisses science and tells them to embrace their imbalance and instability as though it's something noble and virtuous, something better than the standard model that has sustained humanity since the start. We're told to embrace destructive lifestyles that go against the natural order. Even though today LGBT is embraced and preferred above the primordial family unit, we must consider the high depression and suicide rate among this group. It's a loud and clear sign something is out of whack. Part of this, I think, is the unconscious knowledge that they have a body with misfiring wiring. They feel it, therefore the acting out in outlandish and unstable ways. If gay or gender dysphoria is something that is wired into a baby in the womb, shouldn't we explore the hows and whats? You see, even the thought of that is unacceptable to the mainstream because it requires the truth that sexuality is not a social, fluid construct, but a biological reality. How would gays or trans feel if they knew this information, that they were hardwired in the womb through hormonal triggers? Would it be easier for them to understand their situation? I think so. Wouldn't it be easier for religious people to know it's not demon possession, but has a biological basis? What if we had a way to track the sexual wiring process in the womb and can alter it naturally from going off course? You see, we're so far gone from nature that even suggesting this is off the table because we're heading into a destructive, anti-nature-based society. What if we learn that certain foods, chemicals, and pills interfere with this natural process even into one's childhood? You see, I don't think this info will ever be mainstream because LGBT is used politically to create chaos and division in the West. Gender studies was never about getting to the truth. It was always about destroying the culture that revolves around the primordial family unit. Lots more to say with Claire Randall, who has an honors degree in philosophy and psychology from Leeds University, a postgrad diploma in art therapy, and she worked in psychiatry, mental health, personal development, and taught psychology in further education. Claire Randall, coming up. Welcome, Claire. I'm glad to have you back for part two, which will be an unexpected conversation, I think. So thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you very much for inviting me back, Lana. This will be an interesting experience for all of us, I think.
Well, we're going to talk about a lot of things, sexual differentiation, hormones, gender studies, trans, and a lot more. But first, you have a warning to give us, don't you?
Yes, I do. Now, some of the listeners who might have heard the previous interview, may have read my blog on what's known as the amygdala hijack. What this is, for those who didn't read the blog, is that the amygdala is a part of the brain which is involved in, it's a trigger mechanism which is taken advantage of by trauma-based mind control, basically. What it is that when you come across something which has an association of some kind of anxiety, conflict, difficulty, fear, then a fight or flight response can kick in. And this was the idea behind the what the media are taking advantage of their picture of that drowned child the other week. Basically, and you see something that's upsetting, it quite often can lead to an instant reaction whereby your emotions completely take over. And it's really, really important if you want to get past this, if it's only just information, if it's a tiger, it's probably worth responding to. But if it's just information that you're hearing on the internet, it's worth waiting until you get to the end and making a rational assessment of everything that you've heard. Because I think there's going to be stuff that we're going to be talking about this evening, Lana, which might trigger a few people's amygdalas. So I just wanted to give that warning. Just hang in there and wait until you've heard everything before you reach for that unfriend button on social media.
Absolutely. It's good to ruffle things up and challenge some of our ideas sometimes. Well, for a while now, I've been talking about hormone-disrupting chemicals and their effects on the human body. I've also touched upon how I think gay happens in the womb through various hormonal processes. So, Claire, let's start by talking about the biology of sexual differentiation, since you know so much about it.
Well, this should really be common knowledge. When I was an undergraduate at Leeds University, I had the great pleasure of studying physiological psychology with Dr. John Blundell, who over the years has become professor of the department. And he had been involved in a lot of research himself on how the hypothalamus works with hunger, thirst drives, and this is also related to sexual drives. And although I don't think he had actually done the experiments himself, back in the 1960s, there had been a lot of work done on sexual development. And since rats are very, very similar biologically and neurologically to humans, there was a lot of research done on basically tweaking prenatal hormones in the womb so that the rat embryos would have different effects of different hormones, different levels primarily of testosterone or estrogen, which causes the development of either the physical sexual characteristics or the neurological differentiation. And it was found that what we would call homosexual behavior can be induced in rats by basically giving them the brain structures, the hypothalamus and other organs within the brain that would actually be more appropriate to the opposite sex. Now, this has been actually studied more since in the early 2000s. some researchers by the name of Goren, Zhu and Schwab did several studies on humans, because it had been discovered that in humans, a nerve plexus called the striate nucleus was sexually dimorphic. In other words, it's different size in males and females. But they had also found that the size of the striate nucleus in male to female transsexuals was more like the size in a woman. So what this is basically suggesting is that there are brain structures which not only you know, mediate gross measurable things like hormones, but actually affect the individual's sense of their own self identity. And also within the last 10 years, I think it's about 2005-2007-ish, Professor V.S. Ramachandran of University of California has done quite a lot of research related to this in brain mapping, and he has published studies in the Journal of Consciousness Studies, amongst others, indicating that transsexuals who have a sense of bodily dysphoria, in other words, they have a sense that their body is different from what it really feels like they should be. In fact, Ramachandran actually, in his study, he found quite a large number of female to male transsexuals who actually had what he described as a phantom limb phenomenon, except for a male organ. So basically, these people had grown up for their whole lives feeling that they should have had a penis. This is, and that they just feel that it's wrong. And this is a comparable reversed morphic sense is present in male to female transsexuals. So you have the evidence of Ramachandran, which indicates body mapping in the cortex, which is different, and you also have the Gurren and Zhu evidence, which indicates that at an activation level, so there's more than one. I think this is an important point to bear in mind, is there are probably, well, we've seen two at least here, and there are probably more structures in the brain which mediate sexual behavior, sexual identity, and so on. So we have the work that was done as far back as the 60s. This was primarily more in terms of sexual behavior rather than sexual identity. But so we can see from all these different scientific studies that gender and sexual behavior are clearly governed and mediated by sexual dimorphism in the brain. Now, that's something I think that is easy for people to establish this by researching. Now, I'd like to then go on to a couple more examples which push this model further. There's an absolutely crucial condition known as the androgen insensitivity syndrome. And now what this is that I believe it's a small genetic marker, but I could be incorrect about that. The point is that what happens is that an XY fetus embryo, which would normally, with the Y chromosome, would go on and go through the developmental process of developing male gonads, then they would produce testosterone, and then that would androgenize the fetus, and the whole sexual differentiation process would proceed. But what happens with a child, an embryo, that has this androgen insensitivity is that when the gonads start producing male hormone in the womb, which it does, which is supposed to then govern the sexual differentiation of the embryo, something in the cellular makeup of the child which is androgen insensitive. So the child then just develops as morphologically female, because all fetuses of all mammals, and probably reptiles as well, but anyway, of mammals, begin as female and then either carry on and become mature females, or else they are influenced by male hormone and then they become...
Right. They get the testosterone surge, which makes them a male.
That's right. That's right, and it gives them, as you've so well spoken a couple of times, but the guy brain.
The male brain, yeah, that's right.
That's right, which is, you know, which is quite obviously, there's different stuff going on there in terms of evolution.
Well, I just wanted to add real quick, it is interesting when the sexual brain, as you're talking about, can develop differently from the sexual organ. So sometimes they don't always match up. That's why you have there's some gay men that feel like they have a female brain, or that they're more like a woman. And there were actually some tests done in Sweden. They were testing gay men and found that they actually had more of a female brain. So this is very interesting.
Well, yes, that's right. And the thing is, there is no absolutely fixed template for how this works out. Because, as you yourself have mentioned, more than once, I think, with all the feminizing chemicals in the environment that we're all exposed
estrogen to. Estrogen mimicking mostly, yeah.
That's correct. Bisphenol and I believe soya are chemicals are also related to that. So there is an increasing incidence of this feminization that is taking place on embryos, on fetuses before children are born, and it may not always produce obvious external morphology differences, but it can affect the neurology of the brain, and because there are different parts of the brain that may be affected by this, the behavior may be affected, but not the internal mapping. I think this is probably what's happening with gay men, is that because the influence of hormones is quite complicated and it's sometimes contradictory, you know, reverse things can happen to females who can themselves then find themselves developing, you know, male hypothalamic drives or whatever.
Yeah, some people say, well, there's always been gays and before chemicals, but I'm not saying it's just synthetic chemicals. It's hormones in general that guide these processes. But now we have more of these estrogen mimicking chemicals. And it seems that we have more homosexuals, more intersex, more, you know, gender reassignment surgeries happening. And I think that there has to be a connection. What do you think?
Yes. Oh, well, I do. I think obviously the chemicals which have been getting into the environment throughout the 20th century and very much more now within the last generation or so. And obviously this is quite a problem and probably lead to lowered birth rates, a topic which is not exactly a stranger to your show. But also at the same time, as we so often find with real phenomena, I believe it's very much the case that the cultural Marxists have taken advantage of this, because even with the increased levels of intersex and these, you know, messing up of the brain structures, it's most people still turn out the way nature intended, and it's still only about 3 or slightly more percent, perhaps, of people who are actually gay. But as we know, it's particularly something has happened in the last year or two that has now changed the political climate so that what is about 3% of the population and basically neurologically determined is now turned into a social movement which dominates. Do I need to say more than that? I mean, obviously, there is obviously something going on here, which is a long way from what even accepting that these are genuine neurological conditions, that the way that it's turned out, I think is going a long way away from that. And I will explain why, because over the last 8 or so years, I've had quite a lot of association with the Leeds University Gender Studies Department. It just started as a casually meeting one or two of their doctoral students. But then I discovered that their studies have absolutely nothing to do with what we've been talking about. So
yeah, they don't even get into the biology, you mean? They don't even touch that?
No. I remember, I think it was one New Year's Eve when I was at a late night party, and one of these students was there, and I said, oh, well, you know, so where are, you know, where is gender studies with, you know, this biological and neurological differentiation I was talking about earlier? And she said, no, that's irrelevant. So I said, how can the basic biological substrate of how we come about to be irrelevant when you're discussing? And they said, no, they're only interested in the social aspects of gender.
Yeah.
So I then kind of looked a bit further, and I realized that they actually, they're actually hostile to any form of recognition of the biological determinants of this.
It's very suppressed. They keep this information very, very quiet. They don't want you looking around. They just, you know, no, it's a choice. It's a choice. It's just a social thing, right?
Yeah, well, and they completely ignore what has been basically established for about 50 years in terms of neurology. And actually, I looked into this, and basically it seems to be the case that the gender studies department and the psychology department have virtually nothing to do with each other. They call themselves the gender studies department, call themselves the interdisciplinary department of gender studies, but it's all from social sciences and nothing from the hard end of psychology. You know, the biological, neurological stuff, nothing.
It's interesting, when I've been looking into some gender studies material, what's the one connection I always see? And it's this anti-white politics goes hand in hand with gender studies. Have you noticed that?
Well, yes. I mean, it's slightly branching out from what I'm talking about here, but I do actually recall an instance of that when there was a half-day seminar earlier this year put on by the Gender Studies Department. And one of the perks about being a graduate of Leeds University is that you can go along to these things. And there were four speakers, and one of them was speaking about, well, the subject was about what they call lad culture and how to deal with it. Now, I don't have a problem with, you know, issues of dealing with boisterous lad culture. How do we deal with it? Okay, fair enough. But one of the subjects that came up was that some research had been done on different groups of students and how they behaved toward, how different groups of male students behaved towards female students at universities and establishments of higher learning. And I was absolutely appalled to hear the professor or head of the visiting head of this other department say that immigrant students had been found to act in less socially acceptable ways, shall we say, to the female students than the white students. And so to get back to your point, what was really, really interesting was that this visiting guest lecturer then immediately excused this on the basis of, oh, well, they will have had different social expectations, so we must make allowances for them. But of course, you know, I would think most 19-year-old boys probably don't really have much, you know, sensitivity about social perceptions and such like. So it was just, it was complete apologetics for people of different cultures not acting with the same degree of responsibility that the white boys are expected right. to.
I wanted to go back and cover, I wanted to hear about the David Raymer case.
Oh, yes, this is another one of the absolutely foundational cases and studies that, right, David Raymer. Now, David Raymer was one of two twins. He was born in the early 60s. And this is just such a tragic tale. He and his brother were circumcised shortly after birth at the hospital. However, David Raymer, unfortunately, lost his male organ. This is, you know, God, it makes you cringe to think about this. Now, this, I don't have any, you know, evidence about this, but I can't help thinking this is a bit suspicious, the way that it worked out, because this was taken place at Johns Hopkins University Hospital. And when this medical accident took place, Dr. John Money, who was then considered to be a leading expert in this, who happened to be a professor at Johns Hopkins University, suggested to the parents that it might be better to socially reassign the child as a girl, to basically perform sex reassignment surgery on this child, which is probably only a few days old.
Jeez.
And bring up the child as a girl. Well, you know, 1960, 61, whatever it was. And of course, the medical profession had a much higher kind of respect rating in those days, perhaps, than they do now. So the parents were persuaded. They thought, well, what else can we do? And they probably got a, you know, generous compensation package. But so when I was at university in the mid 70s, this particular case, now, because it was a, because the person had to have their identity anonymized, it was just known as a, you know, an anonymous case. And every few years, John Money would publish some update on it. And in the mid 70s, when this child was apparently in their, you know, early teens or thereabouts, John Money was publishing reports that this child was adapting well, was taking on the female identity, and this was all going fantastically well and everything. And so we all thought, oh, well, this is kind of, this is an alternative view to all the brain stuff. So we're saying, oh, well, the brain stuff, you know, the rats and all that, that's one sort of source of information. But then they're also saying that, oh, well, perhaps the brain is more neuroplastic to socialization than we might have imagined. So, okay, so these two, social plasticity and the neural hardwiring, those two hypotheses kind of were kind of equally balanced against each other. But this is not the true story, because it came out, well, there was a very, very interesting documentary broadcast in the early 2000s about this. shortly before David Reimer himself actually committed suicide, and not surprisingly for what he'd been put through. Because as a teenager, he had an increasing sense that there was something wrong, and that he didn't feel like a girl, even though, in fact, Dr. Money was actually going to the point of trying to brainwash him. In fact, he would have the two children and he would actually get them to undress, and he would point at the boy and say, "That's a boy." And he would point at David and say, "That's a girl." This is kind of almost incredible, really, isn't mm-hmm. it? But it actually happened, right? Anyway, by his late teens or in his early 20s, David Reimer eventually found out what had happened. His mother told him, and she said, "You know, we're terribly sorry. We just didn't know what to do. The doctor told it would be for the best and everything." So David Reimer then started taking male hormones, started to get what constructive surgery he could, which must have been immensely difficult for him. And then in the early 2000s, this all kind of went public, and it was, well, basically a horror story. And even though they were, you know, given compensations, both of the Reimer twins eventually committed suicide, because it was just obviously such an immensely awful thing to have for them their whole lives.
Yeah.
You know, even the twin brother, you know, they had their lives taken over by Dr. John Money, who I can only speculate as to, you know, how he got involved with this, whether there was any, you know, covert attempt to deliberately mutilate the boys. Well, I mean, obviously that's purely speculation, one can't say, but anyway, this whole case is not even discussed. It's not in the gender studies curriculum. And yet they claim that gender identity is an entirely socially acquired construct. Don't we love that word? Well, we know how gender studies likes to see everything as socially constructed. And it's also, we've seen so much in related areas of feminism. It's very politically motivated. Well, I got this email from Sally Hines, who is the director of gender studies at Leeds University. It's a bulk mailing. I mean, I'm just on the mailing list. This was advertising a conference at University College of London Anthropology Department. Cultural anthropology, Boasian stuff.
Of course.
And yes, and this took place in June. Conference stream on radical transfeminism, London Conference in Critical Thought. So they're talking here against a backdrop of social gains by mainstream LGBT movement. The reality of trans lives continues to be one of struggle. And then they go on to talk about addressing the social, material, and political necessity of transfeminism as a radical and potentially revolutionary sphere of thought and practice. It will address the importance of a transfeminist critique of the limitations of liberal transgender politics that are being rapidly and unquestionably taken up across the world. It specifically looks to extend transfeminisms beyond rights discourses, and it gets into the kind of heavy.
What a mess! It just makes my head hurt. What do these people want?
Yeah. Well, what they want is they want to completely deconstruct all notion of gender. You want to get rid of notions of male and female, heteronormativity, any form of taxonomy, in other words, categorization of differences between individuals. Did I mention establishment of queer theory? I don't know if you've heard of
not,
queer
not theory. Yet, but yeah, tell us about that.
Right, okay. Well, I'll just read a quote out from Wikipedia here. It says, "Queer is, by definition, whatever is at odds with the normal, the legitimate, the dominant. There is nothing in particular to which it necessarily refers. It is an identity without an essence. Queer, then, demarcates not a positivity, but a positionality vis-a-vis the normative. These things, they spread like spiders' webs, don't they? But I would like to pick up on this business about normativity, because one of the things that you hear so much about these days is the oppression of heteronormativity. Do you understand that? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. Maybe you can clarify it for listeners.
Yes, I think I better. Okay, normativity, that is what is the dominant feature in a society. Heteronormativity is the fact that 97% of the population are heterosexual, and therefore that is normative. This is considered to be oppressive by gender theorists.
Nature is oppressive.
Of course. So what this is all about is breaking down heteronormativity. Now, I haven't really mentioned much here about survival adaptation. I think this is one that Professor McDonald will relate to here, because survival adaptation is basically, it's the central keystone of life, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we do not have survival adaptive qualities, we go extinct. Now, I saw an absurd piece not long ago in which some gay rights or LGBT activist was basically claiming that heteronormativity is wrong, because if we had a homonormative society, heteronormative people would understand what it's like to be excluded and blah, blah, blah. Okay, and there was no recognition of the fact that if you had a homonormative society, it would be extinct within a generation or two.
Well, that's right. These exotic lifestyles are going to lead to total destruction in the end.
That's right. So while we have to accept that the non-normative is a small natural part of the human ecology, that to try to make what is non-normative into normative, obviously the 3% against the 97%, it really simply doesn't make any sense. And yet, this is what this conference was trying to do. It's trying to basically get, there was a bit, I think, wasn't there, it said something about going beyond boundaries. We don't want boundaries. We don't want to distinguish between
They would say, don't put me in a box when you ask, well, are you gay or do you like men or what? Don't put me in a box. My sexuality is fluid, right?
Well, yes. So I suppose this is probably the point, Lana, where I have to, kind of come clean and say that I had what's known as gender reassignment some 30 years ago or so. And that was in the days when it was considered to be a medical problem, and they recognised the brain structure evidence that existed at the time. And it's an experience that I went through, and I'm not here to whine to your readers about your listeners about what a dreadful life I've had because of it. It was a medical problem I had, and I dealt with it. And the only reason I'm talking about it now is because it gives me what they would probably say, positionality.
Absolutely, yes.
Because what I see with this radical transfeminism, what I see with queer theory, is a complete attack on scientific understanding. We need to understand these things. and we need to understand them in a scientific way. We need to look at what causes them. And so that when, because I think one of the things that's very much happening at the moment is that while I think we're comfortable with a figure of, say, 3% or so of people who are kind of hardwired gay, I think that people can acquire what you might call recreational habits. You know what I mean?
Recreational sex is different than procreational sex, definitely.
That's right. And you and Henrik have both mentioned on your shows over the last year or two about how different, shall we say, activities are promoted. So it's a bit like just as we're having all these things, you know, if you're not engaging in gay sex, then, you know, you're homophobic and you should experiment. It's kind of a little bit like the race mixing dating thing as well, isn't it? It basically, what they have to do is, what they're doing is that anything which is normative, anything which is adaptive, has to be deconstructed and destroyed. I mean, I've heard students from our gender studies department talking about, they're saying, oh, when I go back to uni next term, I'm going to join the feminist society and get them to queer it up a little bit because they're not queer enough. And then they talk about the gayification of society. I think you've probably come across that.
Oh, yeah, sure. Now, it's interesting because there is a sector, and we know them, in the alt-right movement of gays who are very much against this degenerate behavior. Uh-huh. But it seems like a lot of gays are really falling for that. It's somewhere they've been programmed to almost hate this primordial family unit or straight people. Have you seen at what point that started being programmed into the LGBT scene? I think having this information come out of the biology could be very, very healing all around.
Oh, well, I think it's important that people understand that there's a lot more to this than simple, social fashions. I think it's very important that people do understand this is biology, this is hardwired neurology to a large extent, which can't be changed. I mean, I said I wouldn't say too much about my own story.
Yeah, I want to know. I mean, was it difficult for you?
Well, the thing is, I went through a crisis in my mid-20s thinking, because I'd seen all this evidence when I was at university. I'd had these feelings since I was the very earliest age as a child. And I did think that John Money could be right, you know, if it was possible to reprogram myself. I thought, is this some kind of sexual perversion I've got here? But then I thought, well, I've had this since I was four, my earliest memories. And maybe, you know, there's more to it than that. And then it was only after I actually went through, my art therapy training, I realized that this wasn't something I could change about myself. So I spent a bit of time thinking about it and researching it and deciding that, I had to give it a try. And if I could manage it, I would. And if it didn't work, then I would at least know that I had, you know, tested the hypothesis. But actually, things have gone pretty well.
Now, when it comes to the brain, I mean, once that sexual part of your brain is wired, it can't be rewired, right? It's done.
Yes, yes. If you've got this, say, this the striate nucleus, it doesn't change. I mean, once it's become an adult, I mean, one of the things about some of these is that they can evolve in adolescence. So one of the controversial points we're getting at the moment is trans children. Now, the thing is that because the hardwiring, because the brain develops, the hardwiring kind of matures, it maturates during childhood and teenage years, so that it is possible that children can grow out of this. Now, this is a subject which is in the very early stages and it's not really fully understood. But there definitely have been people who have grown out of it. And but at the same time, there are those, you know, such as myself, who have had this impression of oneself since earliest childhood. And I do believe that people such as myself do have, you know, are completely hardwired in some kind of morphological recognition or something. So I would say that there are cases where it's hardwired. There are cases where it can evolve or mature.
Because there are cases, too, of gay men that they don't have the female brain. They have the male brain. So I wonder what would happen if they got surges of testosterone, because we know hormone therapy works one way. So why not the other? Of course, this is controversial. You get, you know, scoffed at for even bringing this up.
Well, giving male hormones to transsexuals, I don't know if this is quite what you had in mind, but giving male hormones to transsexuals is supposed to be able to help some, but I would say that it would probably only help those who were actually in a state of mental confusion. Now, I myself, you know, going through this world, I've known quite a few people who have, you know, been in this LGBT world, and I've known quite a few who have actually basically realized that it wasn't for them, that it was just a, how you might say, well, it was like a delusion that they had, or a fantasy. I knew somebody quite well who fortunately backed out before they took the medical treatment too far. But there are apparently quite a high proportion of people who go through this medical treatment. And I mean, there was a doctor in England, Dr. Russell Reed, who had his license revoked to recommend transsexual treatment because he had been recommending people for transsexual surgeries who later regretted it. Now, my own view on these people who regretted it is that their own kind of mind, they should have known better.
Yeah, because a lot of them are suicidal, so maybe it wasn't right for them in the end.
Well, yes, exactly. So obviously, Dr. Russell Reed was really being a bit loose. So those people who imagine that you can have something like what they call this, I mean, this just makes me cringe, late onset transsexualism. People in their 30s or 40s saying, well, I just realized I should have been a woman. Or, you know, and you kind of think, what? You know, if because my own view on this is that it's not something that is, you haven't been able to get out of your mind since the very earliest memory, and you've tried everything, but it won't go away, then this is kind of, you know, look into it. But there are so many cases of people who can go through personal crises, midlife crisis. You know, the midlife crisis transsexual is like, you know, one taxonomic type. And gender studies does absolutely nothing to clarify this whole field.
Is it a drastic move? I mean, I think it is. Actually removing the penis.
Well, yes, it is. It is. It's a very drastic move. And I would say that unless somebody has felt that it shouldn't have been there and that it was something that was wrong for them for the whole of their life, that it shouldn't really be done. It's a last resort.
It would be so difficult because you're maiming your body. So I would think there would be other psychological things attached with that, you know?
Well, that's why responsible gender clinics will really test the individual thoroughly, you know. I don't think there is cutting the brain up, I don't think there is yet a test to see about these different brain structures. But obviously you can test the individual's sense of their own identity, you know, by just asking them about when they first had these feelings, how persistent these feelings have been, you know, how they feel about what life would be like if they carried on as they are, and all these things. I mean, obviously, if it's a proper neurologically based syndrome, then there will be there will be nothing that can be done about it. But it's very important that you do have some kind of psychiatric assessment on this, because there are so many people get into this with delusional ideas about it. Like I say, you know, late onset or having it as a kind of sexual fantasy.
I'm curious too, with a lot of these, sorry to interrupt you there, but young kids, like there's Jazz Jennings, and then you hear of these other families now. Jazz Jennings has a reality show, went from a boy to a girl, Jewish family. They have a whole reality show about it. But what do you think about these little kids that are going through these transitions so young? Is that the best point to do it? Or, I mean, how can they decide when they're that age? Well, you said you knew when you were four, though.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, there are people, and this is why it's very difficult, and I wouldn't claim to know what exactly is right for people. I think one just has to take this as advisedly as one can. However, I think that doing irreversible treatments on young children is not a good idea. Because these can be just short-lived episodes from childhood. I mean, I never spoke to anybody about this until I was, I think, 17. And then it was only...
Was your family accepting about it?
Well, I didn't speak to my family about it until I was in my late 20s. Well, no, I did once speak to my mother about it when I was a teenager, actually. And so when I told her when I was in my late 20s, she instantly knew. I said to her, you know, I got to tell you something, Mom. And she just knew. So she had obviously sensed something. And that one conversation I'd had with her when I was 14 had obviously gone in there, you know. I wouldn't have pursued this if it hadn't been absolutely the last resort. Because one of the things is that I realised in my mid-20s that this was something I couldn't change about the way that I felt. So I set about going through it. I got an excellent medical library here in Leeds. So I read all about it.
Well, how are you so unique? Because other people don't talk about these things or look into it. How are you so different?
Well, I don't. I'm sure there are people out there like me out there.
Because not all people that go through these assignment surgeries are loud about it, like Bruce Jenner, of course, right?
Oh, well, yeah, we were going to get around to this. Well, I mean, if I wasn't, you know, using my, quote, positionality here as an attack on the LGBT and whole gender studies deconstruction of heteronormativity, I would be just keeping myself down, and I'd be very happy just to talk to you about my book, like I did last time. There's a couple of pages in the book about this, but, you know, not much. And I think one of the things about the Jenner episode is, now Jenner is actually older than me. So I have some kind of slightly illiberal ideas about this, if you'll forgive me. One of the things is that I wouldn't prescribe whether somebody should or shouldn't, or how they should deal with this. If they have a sense of gender dysphoria, I'm not going to say they should or they shouldn't or whatever. But I do think that there are two things here. One is that you can't expect the 97% to change to accommodate your own characteristics. In fact, I would push that further, and I would say that you can't expect to deconstruct the entire notion of bipolar gender, binary, which is a very unpopular word in gender studies. In fact, I would say that it's contradictory, because why, if you feel that you were, you know, that your brain is hardwired as a one sex and that your body is the opposite, well, you know, it makes sense that if you can to normalize yourself in the sex that appears to be what you are hardwired to be. But so why would somebody like me want to deconstruct the notion of binary gender? I mean, why would I want to do that? That's completely against what I've always had in my mind, what I've always felt has been hardwired, that there are women and there are men, and that's what I should be one, but I don't want to be neither. And this is actually, this is very, very strange, because the lecturers in gender studies at the university here, they seem to want to deconstruct, completely remove this whole notion of there even being a sex.
Yes, they do. Sex. Yeah.
You know, and yet there seem to be an almost like an equal mix in the department of completely normal seeming straight women and completely radical lesbians who want to destroy and tear down everything.
Yeah, it's like you said, in a lot of gender studies, it's like the engine behind the deconstruction of our culture, you told me, and I think that's a good way of putting it.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I mean, you look at, let's see. I mean, one of the things that comes to my mind when you say about that is the femen. We've seen the femen recently, haven't we? I simply don't understand what this is about. I mean, it's probably time to get into, you know, branching out into to feminism a bit more here. I mean, what are the femen about? They want to just destroy the values of our society. I don't really understand what they want. I mean, they just go and...
And they're such a minority too, because the majority of women, they don't speak for us.
But they get
all the attention, you know, George Soros is funding them, so.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think this, it does very much play into the destruction of Europe thing, doesn't it, really? Because that seems to be the feminists are very largely supportive of, you know, the whole war on Europe, and it's all about destroying boundaries, basically, mm-hmm. isn't it?
Yeah, which is funny because they're letting Islam come in. How's that going to work with your ideology here?
Well, crumbs.
Aren't they going to kill, you know, women and gays first if they could have their way?
Well, yes. And this is the point that I feel is really, really, this is the reason why I am willing to disclose about myself here, because when you think about this and you think about the alt-right or the new right, or what you want to call it, and I see in the alt-right there is a lot of hostility to transsexual and transgender. Oh, and if I may just briefly, I utterly loathe the term transgender.
What's the difference there? Right, these nuances I don't know about.
Sure. Well, when I was going through my medical treatment in the mid-80s, the term was transsexual. The alternate word was transvestite. The transvestite is somebody who just kind of did it part-time for fun.
Dresses up, yeah.
That's right, dresses up, sexual kicks and stuff. Then this word, so there was the distinction there. There was the transsexual who was the hardcore trying to come to terms with their life, or the transvestite who's just the kind of lightweight. Anyway, the word transgender started coming into use in the late 80s and early 90s. It was coined by a full-time transvestite called Virginia Prince, who goes way back to the 1970s. But it was popularized much more by Judith Butler, who some of our listeners may have heard of. Judith Butler was the kind of foundational writer of this whole queer theory business, and although I don't think she actually started it, but she's the most well known. And the most commonly referred to term that she uses is that there is a performative element in gender display. So this has been, although it wasn't actually what she meant, this has been used to basically say sexual identity is only display. So if you have a butch lesbian who acts like a man, then that's a man. Or you get a drag queen, well, that's a woman. So simply by the performative behavior or display, then we've gone all the way from biological, neurology, hardwired behavior, to mere social choice. So
I just wanted to interject real
sure,
quick. It's really funny how you look at a lot of these gay couples though, and you see quickly who's the man and who's the woman. So they fall into those biological sex roles anyway. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. Oh, well, there has been over many years, there's been a lot of controversy within the gay community about this. There are still those in the gay community who like to attack those who are in any way normative, you know, because the you know, like the kind of gay couple you've mentioned, you know, they are in a sense, even though they might not see it themselves, they are in a sense fitting into a normative structure by the fact that, you know, one is obviously the man and one's obviously the woman, even though they might both be men or both be women. But that the gender studies people want to make more out of this than it really is, while it is actually, they are actually fitting into normative structures. The gender studies people would like to say it was actually, the evidence was actually the other way around. I think I've gone off a little bit from
where
okay. I was.
Claire, I wanted to ask you, I wanted to get back on the new right. So how do you see, because there are racially aware transsexuals, there are racially aware gays, they respect the traditional family unit, they're not having children, but they see themselves as nationalists. How do you see them fitting in with the new right or the alt-right?
Well, I think it's a matter of survival. I'm completely baffled at where the left in Britain are about this, because they seem to be the left in Britain, you know, is this kind of the liberal consensus of you know, open-mindedness towards gays and LGBT and stuff like that. And well, okay, that's all right as far as it goes, but they're also completely open-minded to the invasion of Islam and all that, and they're completely unaware of the clash between these two different ways of life. And I think they just need to realize that we need to tighten up here, so that we're not giving away our survival adaptation to strangers. What I mean by that is the Western LGBT movement people, they are European people, they have the European open-minded freedom kind of mentality, but are completely failing to understand that they are sacrificing this by being totally leftist and open to, you know, the
degenerate behavior, I suppose.
Yes, well, I was thinking
anti-white politics.
Anti-white politics with Islam, basically. That's what I was thinking of. And I think we need, if I try to wrap up my thought here, what we need here is a balanced compromise between the alt-right and the LGBT world, because I know the alt-right, they despise the LGBT world. And in many senses, I despise it with them.
I think they do as a political movement because they see how it's being used.
Exactly. Yeah. It's used to deconstruct society. It's used to, of course, there's the whole gay marriage and gay adoption thing, which you've gone into with some of your guests recently. They don't understand that what they're doing with all these things is making our society run downhill. So the LGBT left need to get serious about their own survival, but at the same time, they need to tighten up their morality and so that it can be more respectable. It can that the right can have more respect for it, because I'm not surprised that the way that they are feeding the deconstruction of our society is sneered at by the right. I mean, why not? Crumbs, it's awful. So the right is likely to respect gay people more if they stop flaunting it. I mean, one of these things is that it's a matter of ethological display. I'll explain that for the listeners. Ethology is the study of animal behavior and comparative behavior. So humans are rational animals. We have animal instincts. But we are able to manage and direct our animal instincts. But at the same time, we respond to the instinctual displays from other human beings. So what you're having here, and I think this is a really, really important point, is that people, when they see gay people flaunting, and I'm not just talking about holding hands in public, but that some of these gay pride events and stuff, and I've been to them and I've seen them, and you kind of wonder what it's all about. It's not surprising that heterosexual people don't like it, because it is sexual display, and particularly, Northern European people are very restrained, very conservative, very chaste even, I would say, compared to a lot of the values that you see displayed by, not all, but certain elements in the gay community. And I think that it's an instinctual response. It's not homophobic or intolerance. I personally, I don't like to see anybody getting too physical, or you know what I mean? Too
expressive. That's just it. Yeah, it works two ways here. Yeah.
Within, my view, I think it's just bad manners. I think it's bad manners, whether it's heterosexual or homosexual. But what you see quite clearly with a lot of people in the gay community is they deliberately flaunt this. They deliberately shove it up people's noses. And it creates ill will. And it's not surprising, because what can you do? If you have an instinctual response against something, then, you're kind of almost into amygdala hijack territory.
Well, it's like Bruce Jenner, they're lifting him up as like some sort of a hero. You notice that?
I know I should have looked into this a little bit more, Lana, but I just see it come up on my kind of news feeds and sidebars and things all the time. And I haven't really looked into Jenner all that much, because it's quite clear to me that it's nothing other than just another reality show. Isn't Jenner involved with the Kardashians or something?
Yeah, and the stepdad, I believe. He was an Olympic athlete.
Yes. And I think this is, going back to my thing I said earlier, I don't want to, stop people living the lives that they want to, as long as they don't harm other people. But I think when you leave it to the age of 62 and you've been a public figure and that the nature of being that public figure has been as a male athlete, I think that this is somebody who's trying to have two lives. You know what I mean? You know the phrase, having your cake and eat it. Because when, my feeling was that I had to get it sorted by the time I was 30 because, you know, I'm interested in astrology as well. And astrologically speaking, by the time you get to when you're 30, you have passed your Saturn return, which is the first major rounding of who you are in your life. And I knew I had to get it sorted by then. Otherwise, I would have missed that window of opportunity. And I think that we do take choices with our lives. And even if you might have something that is hardwired, if you've chosen to do something else with it, as Jenna has evidently done and made a successful life of it, you know, then I think that it's kind of trying to have too much out of life by then saying, oh, well, that wasn't really me. This is who I am after 62 years. I mean, you know, my first 20 odd years where I was, I'm nobody. Nobody knows about that other than what I disclose. And, I didn't establish myself in the way that Jenna did. And so I think that it's kind of just playing into this whole circus hoopla.
Yeah.
And
well, I wanted to ask you about that. How should heterosexual people deal with some gays and transsexuals that are hostile? Because it seems to me like there's a lot of hostility out there right now.
Oh, I don't know, really. I mean,
is it a separation or what needs to happen here?
I don't know. I suppose the thing is the actual numbers are quite small, but the people are very vocal.
Yeah.
So one Jenna or, one of these high profile people can be heard by millions upon millions of people. And anybody who wants to convey a more conventional view is just completely sidelined. So it's difficult to know what to do about this because this is not something that's going to go away. And I don't think it needs to go away, but I think it needs to be dealt with in a more constructive way. But I do think that the LGBT people who get hostile against straight people for, you know, not being completely accepting of them should also probably just have a think about some of the things that I've said about the fact that, you know, 97% of the population are heteronormative and they have that right to be so. You know, I don't feel that I in any way, you know, having a neurological abnormality, have the right to try and impose my neurological eccentricities on the world. So we need to accept that this is a reality, but we don't need to be emotionally blackmailed and dominated for it in the way that, you know, gender studies is telling us we're all so dreadfully immoral for, you know, holding old-fashioned ideas that there might actually be something as, you know, a reality such as two sexes, you know.
Do you think that there could ever be a LGBT alt-right? Do you ever see the possibility of that?
It seems pretty unlikely, but I think it is actually necessary because it has to start. They have to start for themselves. If all that the LGBT movement does is claim victimhood and demand to be able to have a kind of moral high ground over society, then they will be. It's like all these things, you end up getting a backlash in the end. I think there would be a backlash from society in the end because what we've seen this year, I mean, as you said at the beginning, it's quite a, kind of timely to be talking about these things, because what we've seen this year, particularly in America, is really, I find it kind of frightening that, you know, so much of this has happened. And of course, there's the whole, you know, adoption and issue, which all these things, they do antagonize people, you know, and so I do think that the LGBT movement needs to start becoming more responsible and accepting that they are not, you know, some kind of morally superior class that can claim that, you know, heteronormativity is wrong, because if they don't get more real about this, when the real nitty-gritty comes between Europeans and Islam, they're going to be thrown to the dogs, you know.
Yeah. Well, last question for you. I wanted you to mention the Trans Media Watch lecture.
Oh, yes. I went. This is another one. I've been to two or three of these lectures this year. I went to this lecture at the Gender Studies Department by a woman from Trans Media Watch, which is an internet group that polices transphobia on the internet. And what they're very much into this, there is no such thing as true transsexualism. So there is no, in their notion, they want to break down all kind of boundaries. So for them, trans is not just transsexual. It's the entire range, which again I think is a taxonomic disaster, because you're not distinguishing between any different, you know, differences between someone lifelong transsexual feelings, or somebody who's a weekend transvestite. They simply will not accept. So they have a wide, they draw a wide they have a wide umbrella for this, so that they say, she said at this lecture, she said that it wasn't just 3% of the population were gay, but 3% of the population, she reckons, are actually trans. Now, that would be trans with an asterisk, which is one of these modern terms. It means basically inclusive. But my view, to go right back to where we started, would be that if we are to accept that there are neurological determinants of behavior and identity, then we need to have taxonomic distinctions, such as there is actually a group called the Harry Benjamin Gender Dysphoria Association, which has drawn up a list, and I think there's six categories, going from extreme transsexual all the way to part-time transvestite, and various different levels of persistence of this in between. But within the world of the trans people, this is quite controversial, because this is the distinction between what people think of as transgender, which is this umbrella, as against transsexual. Transsexual is, you get words from some people saying, oh, transsexual, oh, that's problematic, because it's too definitive and, you know, it's elitist. When actually all that we're trying to do with the correct terminology is to be able to distinguish between the kinds of people who really might qualify for gender reassignment, in that they have the extremist forms of these feelings and the most evidence for hardwired factors in the brain, as opposed to those who would probably regret it at a later stage. So I was very disappointed with the Transmedia Watch, because it's failing it's completely failing to understand that we actually here have a constellation of neurological and psychological irregularities, which are not all the same, basically. So, but as so long as people are only concerned with the social behavior and social identification, and completely ignore the neurological and developmental factors, then I don't think the public perception of it will advance a great deal.
Well, I hope people look at sexuality a different way after this conversation, and I hope people have learned something new. It's more complicated than we've been told, of course. Well, as we wrap up, did you have any closing thoughts for us?
Well, there are so many things. It's really hard to kind of sum it up. But I would just say that I'm very disappointed also with the Leeds Gender Studies Department with their actual scientific methodologies, because I've participated in a couple of studies with them, and in both of them, the evidence that I gave was either not taken up or was sidelined. And I think this was because they found out that I was giving evidence that would disagree with their own hypothetical structures of this.
It's the university, just science is off the table, whether it's science of sexuality or science of race. They just will not look at it because these things are being used for political purposes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, biology just does not get a look in, basically. They're not interested. I think the radical transfeminism cult conference, and then he called it a cult, I think really sums up what this is about. This isn't about when I 7 or 8 years ago, when I thought about pursuing some academic work in this department, maybe taking some kind of part-time course with them or something, I thought that they were interested in exploring not just, you know, I don't mind exploring social aspects of feminism and gender identity, but in tandem with properly looking at the biology and neurological evidence behind it. So when I found that it was actually completely politically motivated department, we've had a long history of radical feminism here in Leeds, and this seems to be the current incarnation of it. But I'm very, very grateful, Lana, for the opportunity to shed some light on this and expose what I think are some very poor academic standards in the way that they look at this, and very, very narrow view, and pretty much fixing their ideas in advance of the evidence. So I look forward to finding out if any of them ever listen to this. And
well, Claire, I appreciate you being so open and honest tonight and sharing a different perspective on this topic. Well, be sure to share your websites with us as well.
Oh yes, there's the waking the monkey dot blogspot dot com, and just let me get this. Yes, wakingthemonkey.blogspot.co.uk or com. Stuff about my book Waking the Monkey, which is largely about breaking out of a mindset of victimhood. And then there's also my PC Newspeak .blogspot.co.uk, which is some of the stuff that I've been talking about today can be found in there about the amygdala and a long piece on gender studies. And there's also my cosmicclaire.blogspot.co.uk, which is just about local issues, primarily around here in Leeds. And the Waking the Monkey blog has also got links through to you can find my book on Lulu. So I think that's everything. Oh, yes, and I've just recently put up a talk I gave to a local arts group about my book, which was filmed earlier this year. So I've put up a link to that on the Waking the Monkey blogspot.co.uk.
Okay, Claire, thank you. Have a good night.
Thanks a lot, Lana.
Well, were you shocked at Claire's big twist? Did it shut you off or make you consider gender dysphoria in a new way? I know many of us have become bitter on LGBT since they've been so loud, degenerate, and hateful. And if you get down to it, on some level, they're bitter about their situation and want to be like everyone else. When there's no resolve internally or truth within oneself, people can act crazy. But if we know someone is cuckoo, we can view it with less emotion. There are those like Claire who can accept that they are an unusual minority and fully 100% support the primordial family. Claire has a resolve knowing about biology and psychology and how cultural Marxism is being used. It makes one stable knowing the truth. Did you know babies being born intersex are on the rise? It's not about the population growth, but about what we're consuming in our modern society. By being unaware or denying, we are furthering this cycle. When it comes to the alt-right, people have differing views on gays being a part of it. If homosexuals are racially aware, not degenerate, support the family unit, and are fighting beside us against cultural Marxism, what's the problem? At this stage, we need all the fighters we can get. The uncultural Marxist model behind the science of sexuality is another topic that both the left and the phony right refuse to look at. That's precisely why I am. We at Red Ice work hard to bring radio 3 times a week, and we really, really want to ramp up our video commentaries. If you want to help us, please sign up for a Red Ice membership to access our extensive radio archives. Visit redicemembers.com. You can find me, Lana, or Radio 314 on Twitter, Facebook, Google+, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and TuneIn. Have a great weekend.